This year, the Guardian's outgoing editor, Alan Rusbridger, announced a major new initiative, his last at the newspaper, to put some heat into its global warming coverage. He told us about it in April.
I think people feel helpless in the face of this story. They see governments finding it very hard to agree on action. And I think they've stopped reading. So one of the purposes of starting a campaign was to give them something to do. And the reaction has been very, very positive.
The Guardian focused its campaign, called Keep It in the Ground, explicitly on the world's two largest charitable health organizations, the Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation. The something to do was the agitation in the form of articles and petitions urging investors to pull their money from fossil fuel stocks, not only because it's urgent environmentally, but because the world's oil reserves are declining in value on their way to being nearly worthless.
Otherwise, we'll have to sit back and wait for the political leaders to go to Paris and do something, which they might or they might not. But I think they're unlikely to move unless they feel the hot wind of public interest on their necks.
That was 8 months ago. Now, after Paris, we're checking back in on the Guardian's efforts to push for divestment with their partners at 350.org, but also to reshape climate change coverage. Rusbridger's successors have since moved on to what they're calling phase two of the climate change campaign, Hope. James Randerson is an editor at The Guardian, and he focuses on environment and science news. James, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the hope part, let's begin with the glory. Is there any so far? What did happen with the Wellcome Trust and the Gates Foundation?
We're still waiting for them to do the right thing, but I think there is some glory to go around. Organizations worth in total $3.4 trillion have now made a commitment of one kind or another to divest. That's over 500 organizations. I think that's a pretty amazing statement from civil society. Gates said that he thinks that divestment is, quote, a false solution. He takes, I think, quite a literal view. He is saying, you know, somebody buys the shares, somebody sells the shares, but nothing really changes in the real world.
If someone divests them, someone else is purchasing them.
Exactly. But we would say actually something quite profound is happening there, because it's about a political statement. And the sum total of those political statements has been adding up. There is now a local campaign that sprung up in Seattle that is putting pressure locally on the Gates organization there. Gates, though, separately and interestingly, back in the summer, made a big announcement about putting $2 billion into research into renewable energy technologies. And now we'll never know, but I think that he was feeling the pressure of the campaign. And although he didn't agree with divestment, that was his response.
Throwing you a $2 billion bone.
Yes, exactly.
If I understand correctly, he also argued against the divestment campaign on sort of psychological grounds, that by focusing on divestment and not on pending catastrophe, you and other climate advocates were leaving, if you will, a lot of reserves of environmental passion in the ground untapped.
Environmentalists have been talking about catastrophe for a long time, and arguably it hasn't got very far. As a newspaper, journalistically, we've been talking about catastrophe a lot. And, you know, as Alan said in that clip, a large group of people have stopped reading those kind of stories. You know, the argument that Gates is making that there's some kind of sort of finite well of concern, and that by diverting the concern over here, it means less gets done over there. I'm not sure it really works like that. What we've seen with this campaign is loads of organizations have made the decision to divest.
James, the original campaign was supposed to empower readers to make them feel that they weren't just hapless victims, but that they could actually participate in the solution. You have gone in and spoken to readers in focus groups. What did they tell you?
So one of our fears was that people would react by saying, I don't trust The Guardian anymore now because they've turned into an NGO or something like that. Nobody said that. The very clear message that we had back from people was that we want to have a sense that this is possible. This big change that you're talking about in society and in the global economy is doable, because so much of what you read about climate change is about doom and gloom, how difficult it is. And frankly, most sensible people reading those stories will want to just go and curl up in bed under their duvet and not think about it too hard. And also, I think it made us realise how difficult actually divestment is as a concept to get across. But, you know, the biggest thing that came out for us was people wanted hope.
Climate change isn't necessarily a subject that newspapers look to for feel-good coverage. What has The Guardian found to give its readers hope?
We wanted to make the point that there's a lot going on out there that shows us a way that we are going to be able to change this economy, or at least potentially we are. And in particular, we wanted to highlight solar power, because the cost of solar is just coming down so rapidly, and that is transforming the economics. Back in 2009 at the Copenhagen climate talks, the green economy more generally, solar power in particular, it felt a bit like it was a PowerPoint presentation the politicians were being offered and was really a bit of an unknown. That's one of the reasons, I think, why the stars were just simply not aligned for some kind of agreement at Copenhagen. And the cost of solar has come down 70% since then, and it's continuing to fall, and it's falling faster than people predicted. And that is going to make the whole transition much easier, and is going to mean that rather than this being about huge costs and government subsidies and taxes and all that kind of thing, if the right policy frameworks are put in place, it will happen.
You mentioned, as did Russ Bridger, that climate journalism has become a kind of fearful background noise. Environmentalists say the sky is falling and the public just pulls up the covers. Now comes your "the sky can be propped up" message. I wonder if there's a risk to suddenly offering hope. Will hope be mistaken for an all clear?
It's a very good point. I mean, I think it's more about turning the dial a bit. I think we realized that we were just underdoing the bit that actually people are probably most interested in, which is how are we going to get where we need to go? And so, you know, we've done a succession of stories of sending reporters out to places like Burundi, Rwanda, Chile, where there are some really groundbreaking renewable energy projects. But that doesn't mean that we're not doing the new bits of science that come out. We're not doing investigations into fossil fuel companies and all the other things that we were doing before.
James, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
James Randerson is an editor at The Guardian, where he focuses on environment and science coverage.
It is delusional for President Obama and Hillary Clinton and anyone else to say that climate change is our near-term most severe security threat. It is ISIS, period.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Litsitsina, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.